Hello and welcome to the Personnel Today Friday podcast. I'm Tara Craig and I'm joined today by Kat Baker and Noel O'Reilly. Coming up, we discuss the political party's immigration policies, one of the hottest topics of the week, and we look into the growing problem of workplace stress and what's being done to tackle it. But first, the news. Royal Bank of Scotland Chairman Sir Philip Hampton has admitted that bankers are paid too much. Hampton told BBC Radio 4's Today programme, "Bankers' pay continues to be astonishingly high, almost certainly too high." A Christian marriage guidance counsellor sacked after refusing to work with gay couples has been denied permission to appeal. Kerry McFarlane was dismissed by Relate when he refused to provide psychosexual counselling to same-sex couples. Law firm DLA Piper has been cleared of sexual discrimination against a former partner. An employment tribunal dismissed all allegations by Sarah Sweeney, who was made redundant from her £1,000 a year post when she was 3 months pregnant. You can read these and other news stories in full on personneltoday.com. Kat, you've been looking into three main parties' immigration policies and their potential impact on the workforce. What are the key points and how they affect employers?
Yeah, thanks, Tara. If we look at the Liberal Democrats first, they've proposed a regional points-based system for Tier 2 skilled migrants. So this is going to try and target non-EU workers at certain areas across the country where they're perhaps less populated or fewer immigrants tend to go to. So they're looking at areas like Scotland for that, which means that they'll be trying to move migrant workers away from areas like London and the South East. I spoke to Sarah Mully from the Institute of Public Policy Research, and she told me that she was concerned that those employers who are based in areas that are considered to have high numbers of migrants, for example London, could actually find it harder to find the skills that they need if the local population doesn't actually meet the requirements in terms of skills.
You also spoke to CIPD's John Philpott, who felt that the Lib Dems' policies might cause real problems for London employers.
These businesses in London, do you think they would then be encouraged to look more locally for their labour, or do you think they would just look to move those operations which rely on migrant workers maybe to where those workers are based, rather than drawing them into the country?
I think it's more likely to be the latter, certainly in the short run, because it's difficult to see where you would get these people locally. I mean, I think there is an important debate about, you know, upskilling the less employable UK workforce and getting people who are economically inactive, into jobs. But really, that's probably more realistic if we're talking about reducing the need for migrants in unskilled or low-skilled jobs. If you're talking about, you know, high flyers at the top end of the talent scale, you know, the idea that you're going to be able to replace those, you know, relatively straightforwardly with, kind of UK job-ready people is just sort of totally unrealistic as far as I'm concerned. And if businesses can't get hold of those employees, the likelihood is that that they'll either move those jobs to other countries, or they'll simply be less effective as employers because they'll be sort of underskilled in terms of the workforces they have here.
He added that it was totally unrealistic for the government to assume that employers would be able to replace these lost migrant skills with UK staff who were ready to take on the roles. He said, if businesses can't get hold of those employers, the likelihood is that they will either lose those jobs to other countries or they will simply be less effective as employers. I also spoke to Jim Hillage, who's the Director of Research at the Institute of Employment Studies, and he warned that for larger companies who operate in a number of sites across the country, they could actually struggle with their migrant staff and they wouldn't be able to move the workers between their different sites because they would have this regional visa and would only be able to work in one certain area. He also stressed that he was concerned that the policy was largely reliant on the availability of very detailed regional skills shortages information, and he said this information was very hard to come by.
There's also a seasonal impact, isn't there? I mean, certain industries, particularly agriculture, will have higher demand for staff at certain times of the year.
That's true. I think areas like the South East, where they rely quite heavily on migrant labour, could find that the numbers of migrants that they have coming to that area could be affected and could be limited. So at peak times, they might not be able to access as number of staff as they might like to or might need to.
What do the Conservatives have in store, Kat?
The Conservatives have proposed an annual cap on the number of non-EU migrants coming into the UK, but they haven't actually set out what this cap could look like. At the moment, they've said that they want to reduce immigration to tens of thousands a year rather than hundreds of thousands. And they've also proposed a transitional control to limit the number of migrants coming to the UK from future EU countries.
How have people reacted to this?
I spoke to David Yendall from the manufacturers group, the EEF, and he said that he was quite concerned that the cap would be set based on the concerns and feelings of the public at the high levels of immigration rather than on the needs of businesses to attract the skills that they need. He also warned that the cap would be very inflexible and that it wouldn't take into account the differences that take place in the economy during the year, and that employers could end up halfway through the cap year not being able to access the staff and the skills that they need because other employers have already taken all the migrants that are available for that year. Pillage from the IES added that this could then lead to an artificial flow of migrants, with employers rushing as soon as the cap is introduced and announced for that year to try and get as many migrants as they think they'll need for the rest of the year. But on a slightly more positive note, John Philpott from the CIPD said that he thought in the long term this policy could actually end up boosting the upskilling in the UK to try and fill the gap left by migrant workers. But he did warn that in the short term, it could actually leave employers struggling to find skills and wages being forced up.
What about Labour? Is it just more of the same?
Yes, Labour have just proposed to continue using the current points-based system to restrict immigration, but they haven't announced how it might be tightened up or if it will be tightened up.
Thanks, Kat. Noel, you've been looking into workplace stress this week in the light of Unite the Union's new not-for-profit sector campaign. Why did they think this campaign was necessary?
Well, basically, they surveyed charity workers and found that 90% feel that well-being was being undermined by the funding crisis, and also there was evidence of some bullying in the sector, which may or may not also be a symptom of the short-term contracts and the funding issues. So the campaign is really designed to try and flag up best practice policies. So there is quite a lot of evidence of what employers think work on this. So there's IRS, the pay specialists. I did a survey last year which showed a range of things, but top of the list of the 121 employers that were surveyed were return to work interviews, followed by phased return to work for people who've been absent through stress-related mental health problems. Referral to occupational health departments was the third most popular practice. Flexible working options and redeployment seem to work, so that there is a range of evidence.
I mean, do you really think it is more of a problem these days, or is it just more reported?
Well, that's a very interesting question, actually. Recently, I saw Max Henderson at the Institute of Psychiatry at King's College London talking about depression. Not necessarily depression as related to stress, but certainly that falls into the same kind of area of mental health. And he seemed to be of the opinion that that there might be evidence of a lot of overdiagnosis of depression amongst GPs. And he did a review of all of the evidence of whether depression was increasing since the time of the Second World War, and came to the conclusion that there wasn't an epidemic of depression, as is sometimes claimed at all, and that perhaps people were more stoic in the 1940s than they are today, but the amount of antidepressants being prescribed seem to be out of line with the actual levels of depression, because there isn't really evidence that it's increasing. And if you look at stress in the same light, to a certain extent, you could argue that stress is being blamed on as a useful label to look for a diagnosis for why somebody's off, which isn't always helpful to employers or employees. What we want to do is really get people back to work. It's proven that that is the best way to actually improve people's well-being if you've got a good job and a good employer.
So what about people who are suffering from stress and are still at work?
People who are suffering from stress and are still at work, from the manager's point of view, they should be obviously trained in the first place, so that they're aware, so that they're on notice when somebody's showing symptoms of stress, whether that's kind of frequently taking time off or just evident in their behaviour. And it's a sensitive thing to address, but that the line manager needs to try and address it. If somebody actually comes forward and says that they're suffering from stress, then the occupational health referral is probably the first action that were available. Otherwise, then they really need to talk to their GP and try and get a diagnosis. But it is all a bit of a murky area.
And Noel, is there anything that employers could offer to their staff as a means of relieving stress and just making them more comfortable at work?
Yeah, what I was talking about before were really, as you imply, really just kind of measures that you take after somebody's been off with stress. But really, employers should be looking at ways to do it, and the best thing is to actually give people a good job and manage them well. But interestingly, some research has just come out. It was bit of research on some employees in Bangor University. They did the study. It's been published in a Scandinavian journal, the Journal of Work, Environment and Health, which shows that yoga classes and short yoga courses can actually improve people's well-being. They offered the yoga courses to people and then also monitored a control group, and they found that the people who did the yoga were less anxious, less confused, less tired and less depressed, and felt more confident, they're self-reporting of course, than the people who didn't do the yoga. And the conclusion that they reached was that short-term programs of yoga were effective for improving people's emotional well-being and resilience to stress in the workplace, and they recommended that employers should consider offering yoga classes. So perhaps that's what we should be doing. We should be actually getting into the triangle pose or something like that with our colleagues, and we'd all feel a lot better.
I'll take your word for it, Noel. You can read all of those stories in full on personaltoday.com. But that's it from this week's podcast. Thank you for listening. Remember to go online to check the latest news and views from the HR community at hrspace.co.uk. Until next week, goodbye.